was asked to speak about the Holocaust, I was initially reluctant to take that on, even though all of us here considered it a historical event that happened to our parents, grandparents, or family members. It is an event of such enormity that for someone who did not actually live through it, it's nearly impossible to fathom or to describe. We've all read about some people who escaped the concentration camps and reporting what was happening, and they were simply believed. They were accused of lying, imagining, embellishing what they were describing. Nobody would believe them, even though they were witnesses. My parents and my in-laws were Holocaust survivors. I often joke that I was raised in Brooklyn, New York, in an area called Canarsie. Now, even though the house that we lived in was physically located in Brooklyn, New York, inside our house, it was Europe. We were living in Poland, we were living in Russia, we were living in Hungary. We spoke Yiddish at home, and much of what we did and much of what we said was in some way connected to the Holocaust, either directly or indirectly. But before we get into that, let's try to wrap our heads around the enormity of the tragedy that simply cannot be expressed in words. First, let's talk about the number 6 million. It's a number that we as Jews and many other people throughout the world say that number and simply roll off their tongues. 6 million, Sheshet Million, Vex Million Eden. It just flows out. Do we have any idea how big a number that is? In the late 1990s, a school teacher in Tennessee, of all places, was teaching about the Holocaust, but her young students were unable to imagine or comprehend the number 6 million. So they started a project by collecting 6 million paper clips. When they were done, they amassed a pile of 6 million paper clips, weighing about 6,000 kilos. This amount of metal would easily fill a standard 10-foot shipping container or a large dump truck. It formed a heap 12 feet long, 6 feet wide, and 6 feet tall. Pretty much the size of the building behind me, 6 feet tall of paper clips. Now, that was a very valiant attempt to try to understand and conceptualize how big a number 6 million is, but in truth, it is difficult and perhaps even sacrilegious to compare a paper clip to a human being with body and soul. An Israeli author by the name of Rivka Galke wrote a book titled 6 Million and 1. Now, I didn't need the book because it's a fictional novel. The title grabbed me because we can all understand how the natural death of one person affects an entire family, perhaps even a community, or perhaps even beyond the community. And then we can imagine what if that death was not a natural one. And then we can further imagine if the person who did not die a natural death was our relative, was dehumanized, tortured, and finally killed in the most horrific way. So we can get an idea of the effect of one person dying. Now, how do we extrapolate that one tragic, unnatural death? 6 million deaths. When I was a kid, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Every person my age or older knows exactly where they were and what they were doing when JFK was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. For the younger generation that didn't live through that, their defining moment, and perhaps many of your defining moments as well, was September 11th, 2001. Everyone knows the war on 9/11. It's an event that is seared into people's memory. And on that fateful day, 2,977 people were murdered. Now, just imagine for a moment, just imagine. Imagine. On the next day, September 12th, another four planes hit another four buildings, killing another 2,977 people. And then on September 13th, it happened again, and on the 14th, it happened again. How many times would that event, four planes hitting four buildings, how many times would that have to be repeated to total 6 million Jews? So you can all pull out your calculators and do the calculation. It would take 2,015 consecutive days, or 5 years and 6 months of every day, four planes hitting four buildings, killing 2,977 people. Think about that number. And the people who survived the war or survived 9/11 are affected for life to those memories. I could tell you about hearing my mother scream in the middle of the night. My mother was in Auschwitz, and many nights she had nightmares about it. My mother would not leave the house to go shopping a block away without some food in her purse, without some food in her purse. She knew firsthand what it was like to be hungry. Throwing food out in our house was a cardinal sin. It simply wasn't done. My father was from Warsaw, Poland. He was the only survivor of his entire family. He did not want to have children. He did not want to bring children into this world, and he did not want them to suffer as he did. My mother begged him, and he finally relented to help my sister and myself. No survivor can escape the scars of their experience. And as a child of survivor, well, I tell my contemporaries and my friends who were raised by parents who were survivors that none of us children of survivors are completely normal either. We have our problems, we have our baggage. In my adult life in the USA, our passports were always valid, always renewed months before they expired, always readily available, never in a bank vault, and all our kids knew where they were. My kids knew you can take whatever you want out of the fridge, you can order anything you want in a restaurant, but you have to finish what's on the plate. You don't waste food. After the war, my parents came to Israel. They got off a boat, and my father was handed a rifle that he had no idea how to use. My parents were here from 1948 to 1960. And my father said that those 12 years in Israel were harder for him than the war years. My parents left to America in 1960 because my father could not be here. Besides the fact that there was nothing here in the country, no work, no parnassa, no food, food was rationed, no housing. He was unable to tolerate the constant air raids, battles, and threats. He lost his entire family in Poland. He was afraid he would now lose his young family again. He developed extreme hypertension and simply could not stay in Israel. Well, our musical family. As a young man, my father sang in the famous choir in Warsaw, Poland. When he came to America, he was a chasm. For many years, he was a chasm at Ohad Tzedek in the Bronx. The rabbi was a very distinguished and well-known rabbi, Alexander Rosenberg, a very prominent and distinguished rabbi. My mother, My mother had the most incredible voice. She actually sang professionally in concerts and even made records. One of the foremost chazanim of the previous generation, David Krestinsky, once heard my mother sing. He took my father aside and said, "It's a good thing she was born a female, because if she was a male, she would have my job." My sister taught music in house for 43 years. So yes, we are a musical family. And yet, we never sang Shabbos Shmiras at home. Every Shabbos, my parents would tell us stories of how was to write the word. That was our discussion at home every week. There were many stories. Most of them are stories of incredible, just incredible miracles and hashgacha practice. Stories that sound like they happened to Hasidic Rebbes, Gdolei Hador, Baalei Kabbalah, not the simple meeting like my parents. Both of my parents' lives were saved by their good voices. My mother was in line to go into the gas chamber in Auschwitz. A Nazi guard approached her and says, "You're the woman who sings at night in the barracks, is that right?" She said, "Yes, I am." He said, "You raised the morale of the prison. They work better the next day. You don't belong on this line." And he took her off the line. The Germans had a saying, "Mutterleugen, Altsverleugen." If your mood is depressed, if you're miyayish, if you give up, you've lost everything. Singing in the barracks in Auschwitz lifted the morale of the prisoners and saved my brother's life. My father left Warsaw in October 1939, a month after the war started, because he saw what was happening. He was 17 years old. He fled east to Russia and through Hashgacha practice, only Hashgacha practice, somehow always was able to stay one step ahead of the Nazis. He was taken in by a Jewish family who treated him like a son, Hashgacha practice. While there, he got a notice from the Russian army that he had been drafted. His quote unquote adopted father took him to the opera house and told the director, "Listen to this young man sing." My father sang a piece of opera, and the director took his passport and stamped on it, "Property of the Russian Opera House." That stamp on his passport prevented my father from being drafted and most likely killed. His life was saved by singing the song in the opera house. The Talmud, the Moral Sutta of Beit HaMikdash, teaches that 40 days before the embryo is formed, the heavenly Paschal comes out and decrees the daughter of so-and-so is going to marry the son of so-and-so. The Gemara is telling us that one's future spouse is determined by heaven even before they are born. My sister was born in 1949. His shidduch was made in Europe in 1944, 5 years before she was born. I was born in 1954. My shidduch was made in Europe in 1948, 6 years before I was born. Both shidduchim, my sisters in line, were made directly as a result of the war. Hashgacha practice. Time does not allow me to elaborate on these stories. Maybe another time. So what's the message I'd like to leave you with in this Tisha B'Av? My message is twofold. What's the Rebbe, the late Kellerman, who the Talmud Rav Shlomo taught us that Hashem was present in Auschwitz at the same degree he was present in Gan Eden with Adam HaRishon. The only difference is that in Auschwitz, Hashem was hidden, and he told us he would be hidden. Anochi haster, astir, tonight. brief stories I mentioned prove that Hashem was in Yeshua and in all the other camps. So we must believe that Hashem is with us here and now, even for the same. My second message is as follows. We here are the fortunate ones because we lived in Eretz Yisrael. When and how ancestors in Chutz La'aretz realize that the writing is on the wall, that history repeats itself over and over again, that what we have learned from history is that we have not learned from history. It is estimated that throughout history, apparently, approximately 30 to 50 countries expelled Jews from their countries. Last week, 104 members of the House of Representatives voted to cut aid to Israel. The writing is on the wall. I will end with this. I heard this from a very, very wise man. He said, I don't think that in the next 10 to 20 years, the USA will pass a blatantly anti-Semitic law like the Nuremberg laws of Germany in 1933. But keep this in mind, he said, keep this in mind. The USA deficit is expected to reach $2 trillion by the end of this year. And the national debt has already surpassed $39 trillion. It is completely within the realm of possibility that Congress can pass a law that anyone wanting to transfer funds out of the USA to an overseas account must pay a 50% tax on that transfer. The rationale is very simple. The US economy simply cannot be sustained if money flows out of the USA. In fact, there are precedents for it. There are countries today that currently have such a transfer tax. And in the USA, the state of Oklahoma has a transfer tax on its book. So it's not a novel idea, it certainly can be expanded on. Now, the farmer in Nebraska or the redneck living in a trailer in Iowa, he's not affected by such a law and won't care much. So the law will be easily passed. But the Jew in New York and in LA and in Chicago and in Lakewood or anywhere else, that is who this law will really target. And it won't be openly anti-Semitic. So the million-dollar house in any of these areas that our brethren are counting on to sell that house and with the proceeds to buy it farther than Israel, well, the sale of that house will generate federal and state taxes. And if you add a 50% transfer tax, it will be left with approximately $300,000, which is just about enough to buy two parking spots in RBS. Abeim, talk to your family, talk to your siblings, talk to your friends. Tell them to come home. Tell them to come home. Or too late.